CliffCentral.com.
All right. CliffCentral.com, Janae Aiko, and The Pressure. Yes, The Pressure. All right. Good morning, inmates. Welcome to day number, I don't even know. Is anyone keeping track of this? Because I don't know what day it is. Do you know what day it is today of lockdown? It's Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. Is that the fifth day of lockdown? Is that possible? Is that right?
The burning platform. No, it's not fifth. It's the sixth day.
Oh. See, yeah, someone
tomorrow will be a week.
Thank you, Canton. So it is time for the burning platform, which is brought to you every week by Nando's. Some things are regular in your life, and you're going to hold on to those and appreciate them a whole lot more. And one of them is the burning platform. It's where we get to check in on all the stuff that is going on, some of it including the coronavirus and what everyone's dealing with, and some of it not. Some of it's stuff that is just bubbling under. We're also joined this morning, I'm thrilled to say, by Waldemar Pelser, who is a regular in South African media and in the South African polity when it comes to commenting and giving analysis on various things that are happening politically, economically, socially. And Waldemar, it's always good to check in with you. I hope you're well. You look like you're in good health under lockdown. Are you keeping yourself busy?
I just rolled out of bed, Gareth. Can't be better.
I'm telling you, it's going to be very hard for us to go back to normal after this because we're quite... Some of us are secretly enjoying it a little too much.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I'm good, thanks.
All right, very good. Jonathan Witt is our friend and a doctor, as well as the host of the Renegade Report, along with Ramon Kabanak. And Dr. Witt, it's always good to see you. You also look like you're ready to take on the day. Have you been working throughout?
Yeah, I was thinking, what lockdown?
Yeah.
What are you talking about?
Yeah, yeah. Well, listen, we're grateful. I'm going to start saying to you what people in America always feel compelled to say to people who've been in the military. Thank you for your service.
Oh, God, please.
Well,
not yet. Thank you.
You probably can give us some insight, and I'm sure you will in a moment, as to what it's like from the doctor's point of view. And we have spoken to a few other doctors on the show, but it's always good to check in with your quite pragmatic take on these things. And Canthan Pillay, who is our regular returning champion. Canthan, how are you doing in that house in Plett where you guys are suffering immeasurably during lockdown?
We were just going to check out this sun.
Hang on, we can't hear you. Start that again.
Yeah, let's try that again. Yeah, so, sorry, my space bar was kind of jumping up and down. Damn you, Apple. Pictures of this magnificent sunrise over the ocean. So it's awful. I can't tell you.
Yeah, I was complaining about celebrities who have no self-awareness and are posting pictures of themselves in the bathtub like Madonna with rose petals saying, COVID-19 is the great equalizer. But do you think, and I haven't spoken about...
Where did you get rose petals? Damn, I've been looking for rose petals. I've not been able to find that.
No, what irritates me is that there are people who completely lack self-awareness during this thing, but they are not the biggest problem. And all those people who've been banking on class warfare in South Africa for the longest time, I have something to say to them, because yesterday I went to the shops, and in my neighborhood, I don't know what the demographics are, but in the queue in front of me, and it was at a Woolworths, so I'm happy to admit that, you know, this is some kind of privilege that I'm meant to feel bad about, but I don't. In the queue at Woolworths, there was a black couple in front of me. In fact, almost all the people in that line happened to be black. Most of them were in their, let's say, 30s and 40s. Some of them in their 20s. Some people in their 60s. It was a nice mix of people. Some Indian people behind me. Some white people, too. Some of them were wearing masks. Some of them weren't. Everybody was well-behaved. Everybody was chilling. They were maintaining social distancing. There was no fear or panic in people's eyes like there was before the lockdown happened. And I think people are slowly adjusting. But the most interesting thing about observing people like this is, again, that we are not in a country where everybody hates each other, where there's extreme resentment between people, where everyone's suspicious of each other's motives. Most of us are just trying to get on with our lives. And especially during a time where we're tested like this, I see a lot of people trying to provide for their families, trying to look after themselves, maybe looking after others as well. We don't know, but I'm sure there are good people in this country who are doing more than their fair share. And it's not as bad as people say it is when they talk about how dystopian and ruined and broken South African society is. Am I being outrageously optimistic just because of my own little bubble? Or is that your experience?
I'll just add that if you want to see how South Africans react in the face of adversity and panic, the queue at Woolies is probably not the best place to go and do your test.
No, I know. I know.
Because those people like us, you know, we have options. We have, you know, many of us have more than one room in the house. You know, you can, there's no real risk of destitution, of, you know, not being able to feed your family. Queues at the big supermarkets in the townships, have been a different story these past few days. And I've not been in one of them, but I've seen footage, streamed from around the country. And just to the social grant payouts, you see the, you know, millions of desperate South Africans standing in queues for 8-10 hours trying to buy the basics, which just a few weeks ago they had the option of buying from street vendors and hawkers and stuff.
Right? Yeah,
at prices that they could shop around. You know, buy your meat here, buy your fresh veggies there. You know, price is the best. You know what quality to trust. Now, ironically, in the age of trying to decentralize commercial power, we have people spending their social grants disproportionately on the you know, in the big supermarket chains, you know, competing for scarce, spending you know, small amounts of money. It's, I think, the desperation lives almost exclusively in the townships.
So basically, you're saying I'm a dick. I understand.
No, not at all. I'm saying that you're like me, and we're so lucky. You know?
No, we are lucky. But, Canton, you wrote something.
No, guys, I'm going to disagree with Valdemar on specific points out here. So, firstly, the pattern in terms of the townships, Valdemar, is that when money comes through, which is generally at the end of the month, and remember that the money did come through pretty much on the day before lockdown kicked into effect. So, the 25th was last week, Thursday, which was the day before the lockdown came into effect. And pattern is, in terms of townships, is that when the money comes in at the end of the month, the big shop ends up getting done at the big supermarkets in the townships. Shops that actually then carry people through for the rest of the month, because in the rest of the month is the time when you're actually out of money and you're hustling and you just want to get together that one loaf of bread, or you want to get that 1 liter of milk, and you head down to the local spaza shop. And generally the spaza shop guy is going to give you stuff on credit, and you end up acquiring that stuff from the spaza shop. And then the first thing you do at the end of the month is you go and pay back the dude. But you do your big shop at the supermarket just simply because the supermarket is able to have loss leaders and you're able to pick up bargains at the time. But one of the things I'll tell you guys, in terms of the class differential, what's fascinating about being in this part of the world, in Plett, is that we happen to have a proximity of low-income and high-income supermarkets. Mm-hmm. You know, so in other words, there's these two shopping centers right at the entrance to Plett, where you have a Pick and Pay and a Woolies and Clicks in one of them, and then you have a Checkers literally across the road. Just about a kilometer up in the center of town, there's a ShopRite and there's a Quick Spot. Mm-hmm. And so I ended up, you know, starting off at the Pick and Pay and Checkers as I usually do. And a lot of things that I was looking for were just not to be found on the shelves. So, for example, flour was completely sold out except for cake flour. I was looking for white bread flour so that I could make pizzas. Mm-hmm. So flour was completely sold out. Lentils were completely sold out. There was a bunch of stuff like that. So I head down into ShopRite. You know, and ShopRite is, of course, the downmarket brand of ShopRite Checkers. Mm-hmm. Okay, so first thing that strikes you is that the person that I saw in ShopRite was black. So they were, you know, whereas the race divide in terms of the Checkers and Pick and Pay, I think it was kind of more representative of the demographics.
Right.
But the other thing is that a lot of the stuff was actually available in ShopRite. So I was able to pick up lentils. I was able to pick up white bread flour. I wasn't able to find yeast, by the way, which has been in short supply for a while.
I heard about this. Is this a real thing?
It is a real thing, but I asked a guy behind the counter for help, and he says, look, my suggestion is just go across the road to the spa where there's a bakery and ask them to give you some wet yeast from the bakery. And which I did, and they sold me a piece of wet yeast, about a quarter of the size of a golf ball for about R5. So it was done and dusted. But you see, what's kind of interesting is that what I'm reading into this, and of course it's purely conjecture on my part, is that the people who are shopping at Pick n Pay and at Woolies and at Checkers have the ability to stock up, and so they've been raiding the shelves. Whereas in ShopRite, it's still pretty much, you know, buying on a day by day basis, right. And that's been the case. But Valdemar, I'm going to make this point. I agree completely that the spaza shops should not have been shut down because they provide that crucial service that actually bridges. But at the same time, it's not the fault of the big chains.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay, well, that led us down an interesting path, but I do think let's get a little bit of intel on what's actually going on from a health services point of view. And Dr. Jonathan Wirtz works as a doctor, and he can tell us a little bit about what the front line may look like now and what they're projecting it to look like by maybe the end of this month. Have you guys been briefed from government and from all the health authorities on what the likelihood is that things are going to change? And what's it like at the moment, Jonathan?
Briefing-wise, not really. I think they're taking a view of treating us like mushrooms, you know, keep us in the dark and feed us shit, frankly. Look, the truth is that there is a lot of modeling going on, and none of it seems to be right. Either it's off too high, which has happened in most places around the world, and had to be adjusted down. The US
would
be a good example.
By that you mean that the proposed and the expected mortality rates and infection rates. You think they've been?
Yeah, I mean, look, I've been fiddling with some models and along with some colleagues, and I mean, the one model that a friend of mine sort of came up with, who also has a public health background, is a worst case scenario of 7 million infections in South Africa. And somewhere in the region of about 600,000 deaths. But, you know, the question is whether we'll get anywhere near that. I think the biggest problem with coronavirus, and as you know, I've had a little bit of a different take from the beginning, is that there's so much we still don't know, and we're trying to say definitive things in the middle of all of this where there is just not enough data. And we will only really know, you know, who was right about predictions and which models were correct, which inputs were right, which mortality or case fatality rates were right, later on down the line. So it's really, really difficult. And I get it. Government's reacting to a potential risk. That's what governments all over the world are doing.
Right.
It still remains to be seen whether those reactions have been correct, and whether they will they'll work out. In terms of where we are at the moment, healthcare wise, we're all waiting for the tsunami of patients. There's a lot of preparation that's happened, both in the public and the private sector, and at the moment, it's quiet. To be frank, it's quite quiet in most of the hospitals. In fact, in all of the hospitals, there are some patients, but it's not yet busy. We do expect that will change. The models tell us that's going to change sometime in April or towards the beginning of May.
Valdemar, you often are the person at the forefront of kind of collecting and deciding on what news the rest of us need to know about. You almost curate this stuff for us in various publications, on your TV show on CakeNet, a number of other places. What do you think people's main interests are around this coronavirus? Is it around the disease? Is it around the impact on the economy? And are those two things at odds?
Gareth, I think most people are being affected. Everybody's being affected by the policy decision to put the country into lockdown. very, very, very few people are being affected by the virus. But I do think concern about contracting the virus is growing, as it should, because there are high-risk groups. And quite frankly, data from the U.S. Shows us that, you know, that young people are very easily affected as well. I mean, Jonathan will be in a better position to say who's affected. So on the health issue, we reported for 2 weeks running now about church service in Bloemfontein and a rugby hero golf day in Jan Kempdorp, both of which became the sources of cluster infections, at least the Bloemfontein church service, where we called up some well-known people who had attended it, Kenneth Meshwe, Steve Swart, the Member of Parliament, and Angus Buchan, and we told them, listen, do you know that that service you attended last week, that there were 5 foreigners there with COVID? And they said, no, we had no idea. We'll have ourselves tested. And 100% of the so-called celebrities that we cajoled into having them tested, tested positive.
Wow.
And skipped 1 week to the golf day of the, you know, these former rugby stars like Donny Carver. And there are 5 infections already in a group of 40 who played golf together. So what we're doing primarily now is telling our audience, wherever I can reach audience, that this is massively infectious, and that people are underestimating the ease with which you can contract it. That's the first thing. But the second thing that I think is very important that we've been pushing very, very hard is questioning the policy response. Because the immediate threat to people's lives is not coming from the virus, but from literally going hungry. UWC published a research report yesterday on how tenuous the grip is of so many millions of South Africans on, you know, food security. And if you limit the supply of food, as Kantan said, you know, some of the spaza shops have been closed down, hawkers can't trade anymore, and can't sell to SASSA recipients in the queues. There's a problem of access to food, and there's a massive, massive, massive problem of not having cash anymore with which to buy food. So my big push at the moment is trying to complicate the conversation about the choice between saving lives by locking us down. This notion that we save lives by locking people down and we destroy lives by letting people trade is a false binary. And some of these regulations that have been promulgated are irrational and, quite frankly, deadly. And I think if we don't critique them and push back like the taxi drivers have done, and I'm not saying that the taxi driver's victory is a good one, you know, but kudos to the taxi drivers for actually pressure on government, saying an unimplementable regulation. Which rational small businessman taxi driver will drive around with a half full taxi? It's completely ridiculous. But I have not seen a concomitant pushback against mad regulations from the rest of society.
Well, it's interesting. People all fall in line, right? They become like sheep as soon as there's a crisis. And even if it's a perceived crisis, and I don't by any means want to downplay the fact that this disease does kill people and that we have a major threat on the horizon in South Africa because of people living in close proximity and with diseases that they're already dealing with, and that this makes us particularly vulnerable in this country. But to ruin the economy, which is already limping, and we discussed this last week, Canton, by shutting down business is not the solution either. There are going to be no jobs left. There already are too few jobs in this country. We're looking at an unemployment rate in earlier January of this year of, what, 29-odd%, approaching 30%. It's probably going to, if you consider that America might be looking at 20% unemployment, we might be looking at 60.
Yeah, Gareth, just quickly, I mean, yeah, losing your job is a disaster. And you know, I'm lucky that I can work from home, right? But if you lose your job, you can claim UIF. And I mean, it's not a lot of money, but you won't starve. But there are, 5 million people in the informal sector who go out of their homes every day, get onto a taxi, go and hustle, do something, paint a wall, clean a house, whatever it is. There's no payslip. And their income dried up, not only last Thursday, but in some cases weeks before that, where people would tell them, listen, I don't want people unnecessarily on my property. Just please go away. And there's no food and no money in those households. And this is a social stability issue. It's a humanitarian issue. And all the focus is on, I mean, that's my impression, is on the clinical questions.
Yeah.
Kanthan, do you want to come in on this?
Yeah, well, you know, there's a couple of things. At some point, I'd like to get Jonathan's take on the fact that we've now got an infection in Alexander Township. But I did want to make a couple of points. Yes, you know, there is the slow death from starvation, but one of the solutions in terms of the ensuring food security is the fact that there are a number of groups out there that have been collecting food and distributing food across the country. Certainly, you know, I don't normally blow my rotary horn in this space, but you know, certainly all of the rotary clubs that I'm aware of have been doing massive collections, and there have been distribution that has been taking place to a number of places. So I think that to some extent what we have is the ability to ameliorate the situation of food scarcity, even though it's less than ideal from an economic perspective. I also think that one of the reasons why it was actually necessary to do things like putting in place measures to protect the spaza shops is the fact is the spaza shops don't have the ability that the large supermarkets have to have someone standing at the entrance who, with a can of sanitizer to spray every single person who comes on board, to actually to have security guards who are ensuring that people are keeping their distance. And these are all things that could become really hectic disease vectors, I think, if there were not actually controls in place. Do we need to actually improve the safety net in terms of all of these business sectors? Yes, but again, Gareth, that goes back to the other point that I've been making, is that if the government had actually not screwed up the economy in the Thabo Mbeki trajectory of growth, this year we would have had 3 trillion more flowing into the economy than we currently do, because this negative growth territory that we're in.
Well, we just saw the news this morning reporting that SARS have had a shortfall of 66 billion rand in their tax collection year ending 2020. This is
But our deficit is a billion rand a day. So, you know, effectively, that's 2 months worth of overspend that they haven't been able to collect.
Sure. Yeah, that's crazy. That's absolutely insane. All right, so what would you do if you were in government? Because it's all good and well for us to criticize. I wouldn't want to be Cyril Ramaphosa right now, because he's got some very tough decisions to make.
He needs to fire half the cabinet.
That's
to start off with.
Yeah, well, especially the ones who we've seen now in this last couple of weeks to be incompetent. You know, there are some ministers who just put their foot straight into the shit every time they open their mouths. And obviously they're being worked harder than ever before, so we can also see which ones are stepping up to the challenge. It's easy to now be able to tell which ministers are worth keeping, right?
Maybe. I think doing one thing on one particular area of their portfolio isn't a claim to fame, frankly.
Okay.
Just because they're focusing on coronavirus particularly well. And I, you know, you mentioned government overreach and how people are just happy to take it lying down. I'm terrified by that. I'm not sure what they give up after this. I know for a fact that Zweli Mkhize, who's doing a particularly good job in dealing with the coronavirus, is also at the same time going, you see, we're doing a good job with the coronavirus. We should therefore have the NHR. And given how our citizens react to having their rights taken away, what's to stop him from just nationalizing private health halfway through this crisis and never reversing that?
And worse, private health just rolling over like, you know, like they've been lulled into submission.
Well, everyone's rolled over. You go to EWC. If they decide to expropriate farms because there's hunger after this, because they've destroyed the economy, most people are going to turn around and go, oh, well, you know, we better let it happen because, and if anyone objects, I'll report them to the police because the law says so. People seem to forget that, that laws can be evil. And that's particularly worrying to me in terms of what the government's done. I mean, I think the realities are here that we're going to the IMF far sooner. Coronavirus has rapidly accelerated us.
On that note, we'll get to the IMF and the World Bank in a second, because I know that there's lots to be said here. But you were asked a specific question by Canthan. Mm. If this virus has its first case in Alex, as we're led to believe it does, and if we are starting to see the entry of the virus into Khayelitsha and other informal settlement areas, this poses a major risk just from the point that Valdemar made earlier about how infectious this disease is. What do you think of that?
Well, I think there's reason for concern. However, we're currently an anomaly in terms of statistics in the world. So we've got 1,380 cases, I think, currently, mm-hmm. Somewhere in the ballpark, and we've got 5 deaths. If you look at the countries in the immediate list around us with similar numbers, their death numbers are far higher. Greece, 1,400 cases, 50 deaths. Mexico, 1,378 cases, 37 deaths. Indonesia, 1,600 cases, 157 deaths. Peru, 1,300 cases, 47 deaths. I'm not sure what's going on here. I think that, and one of the problems in the approach that we're dealing with this is we're not looking for the nuance in the pandemic. So I've said from the beginning that this is a disease of the elderly for the most part. It's not to say young people cannot get affected and be killed, but it's a disease of the elderly, and we are not being smart about how we're managing that. I think it's interesting in terms of our death figures because our average age in this country is 27. And if you look to the rest of Europe, they're all average ages over 40, some over 50. This is why Italy was so hard affected. Now, New York, as an example, is worrying if you start thinking about places like Alex and Khayelitsha, because the density of population is high in New York, and it's even higher in places like Khayelitsha and Alexandra. Right. So I do think those things are concerned, but we just don't know enough. And I think to remind everyone, and this is not some conspiracy theories, William Kesey has said this, NICD has said this, the CDC has said this, we expect the majority of the world population to get coronavirus. It's not about, you're not stopping this virus. You can only get past coronavirus by going through. We are all going to get coronavirus. You can try to flatten the curve if you think that's a good idea. And destroy your economies in the process. But at the end of the day, that is going to happen whether we like it or not. And there are only 3 ways to kill a virus like this. One is to get herd immunity through most of us getting infected. 2 is through a vaccine. And 3 is to burn it all to the ground. So those are our choices.
And according to what you're saying, it doesn't actually seem like a very tough choice, because number 3 is obviously out of the question if we burn everything to the ground, which is obviously what a lot of people in politics have always thought was the solution, is just destroy everything and we can start again from scratch. That's clearly not a sensible option. Herd immunity continues to... Yes, you want to say, Canthan?
Yeah, if I can answer your specific question, because you asked, you asked to all of us, you know, what would you be doing
if you were president
right now? Well, right now that we're not currently doing. Well, I think the single significant thing that I would do as a matter of urgency is that I would have a scenario where we are testing people for antibodies. In other words, that's a way of actually gathering whether they've actually had the virus already and they are now effectively immune, and start a process at this point of certifying those people as being ready to re-enter the economy. I think that that's something that's absolutely crucial.
Do we have any way to do that?
Jonathan is probably best placed to tell me how the testing can actually work on this.
Yeah. So not yet. There's some tests been released by the Chinese and then been sent back because they're 80% ineffective. I think those went to Spain, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
So you know, what's happening currently is that we're doing what's called PCR on the virus, which is if you've got it, they'll pick it up on a swab and then they find sort of viral DNA that they replicate. And then that makes you a positive test. Mm-hmm. What Canton's referring to is serology testing, which is you take a blood test and you see if you've got antibodies to the virus. They're not 100% sure just yet of what that will mean, because you get different antibodies, IgG and IgM. But yes, I think it's certainly an approach being looked at in Germany. It's an approach the US are looking at. I think Canton is correct. He's pointing towards things that can get us back to normal life. And sort of slow spread, at least, accepting that we're going to have coronavirus, whatever we do. And serology testing is one of the ways, but nobody has a great idea yet exactly how to implement that.
Well, I want to read you something that has come up this week, and Valdemar, you can take the lead on this one. But basically, the Institute for International Finance said South Africa should seek funding from the International Monetary Fund, given the country's high debt levels, large capital outflows, and a potentially deep recession triggered by rapidly spreading coronavirus pandemic. The Institute said that it expected South Africa's economy to contract by 2.5%, which sounds low to me, in 2020, but said that waning demand, travel restrictions, and pandemic-related closures could lead to a deeper recession. Now, the EFF, in all their wisdom, and they've been mostly quiet through this crisis because they've had nothing positive to add, but they've suddenly said that they want to reject wholescale what they call the finance minister's flirtations with the IMF and the World Bank. The Red Berets said that taking on outside funding would worsen the country's already dire socioeconomic problems. Tito Mboweni has mentioned that this may be our only option. What do you say to the EFF and to Tito Mboweni and the IMF?
If only the flirtation with the IMF started last week, Gareth. It started a decade ago when the ANC government decided to follow policy courses that were dooming us to failing economically, which forces us into the arms eventually always of the IMF. That's always how that story ends. The flirtation didn't just start. It started without articulating it. It started a decade ago. And I share the view that we might have no choice to approach them. And I know that they are talking about making specific corona-related facilities available. But an interesting point was made by R.W. Johnson last week is that the IMF is in some trouble itself. Many low-income countries are queuing up already for emergency aid and loans from the International Finance Corporation, World Bank, IMF. And we're a middle-income country, which made some very bad policy choices the last decade. I don't think the sympathy levels for South Africa are too high. So we may find ourselves approaching the IMF standing, number 100 in the queue without much sympathy coming from them. So we'll see how that goes. I mean, I have no doubt that we'll get help from them of some sort, but we can't assume that it'll be on the most favorable terms. And we only have ourselves to blame for that. Just very quickly on the policy issue, what one would do. I mean, I absolutely agree with you that the president is in a very difficult situation, and he's done. I think he's done a half decent job, but recognizing the seriousness of the problem, both the economic problem and the health problem. I think that's sound. I also think that Mkhize has he's been quite impressive. He's a medical doctor. I mean, I've heard very few things coming from him that have struck me as completely irrational, which is so refreshing for this government. The government urgently needs to look at those regulations that do not save lives, that are irrational. Not selling cigarettes is just stupid. Not selling booze. I think we're underestimating the risk of rebellion among poor people where a lockdown is simply impossible. It's not. We cannot decide to follow China's example and lock down Alex. Alex cannot be locked down, full stop. There's absolutely no way to do it without violence. Yeah. But, we're pretending as if we are Germany or China. We're not. And there's no country with – we are Germany and we are Sierra Leone, right?
Yeah.
So you can do lockdown in the suburbs. It's fine. I don't care. But you cannot do lockdown where people live 8 to a house. And so we are, I think, on a shortcut to disaster if we don't try to normalize those aspects of the economy that can be normalized without imperiling lives. And Kantan, you know, I agree with him that we should incrementally and in a very focused manner normalize as much as we can as quickly as possible. Otherwise, you know, people will run out of cash.
And can we also just throw in here, I know it's a bugbear of mine, but it's so goddamned irritating to hear a bunch of people who do live in the suburbs policing each other at the moment because they feel they have some kind of control. It's this weird thing of what creeps in. I call it an Australian dobbing of a kind, where you got neighbors spying on neighbors. It's such bullshit.
My twin sister lives near Stellenbosch in a security estate on the N2, and so she decided to walk to the shop, you know, which is an act of rebellion these days.
Like, yeah.
Walk to the shop instead of driving to the shop, and her, you know, as she passed about 20 houses on the way to the gate of the security complex, I mean, she was, you know, she was insulted. You know, people were screaming at her. And my own mother joined in and told her on our family WhatsApp group that you really shouldn't walk through the gate because that's not allowed. And so my suggestion is that she digs a tunnel from her garden to the front gate of the complex and walks through the shop from there, because walking to the shop is legal. And if we do not use our remaining rights to do what is legal, we will lose even those rights.
Well, Jonathan, do you want to just comment on whether or not it makes a bloody difference in the world whether you walk to the shops or not?
Yeah, not a chance. And I just want to address, while we have the opportunity, this notion going around that the virus is airborne, which is not true. There was one article written, I think it was NBC in the US or CBS, one of those two, who wrote an article talking about how the virus can become airborne for a period of time during medical procedures and in hospitals. So when we do certain things that involve the airway, we can cause the virus to aerosolize. And then those aerosols are released into that room or that area, and it is technically then airborne.
So that not a sneeze. A sneeze is not good enough to do that.
So a sneeze could do that, but for a very short period of time in a very, you know, this closed is the other space. Argument about closed spaces is about sending people home in, whether lockdowns work or not. There's some evidence coming out of New York that that was a bad idea because they sent everyone who was sort of at least a little bit more spread out during the day, walking through the streets, et cetera, in open plan offices. And they sent them back into their homes with their families, sometimes with elderly people in those families. And I'm sure we're doing similar things in South Africa. If we've got a case in Alex and people are living 4, 6, 7 to a house, and, you know, grandma is in that house and one of the people who's young is infected and is relatively asymptomatic, then grandma's going to be the one who takes the knock on this. These are some of the worries. But yeah, just on that point, something I didn't say, Gareth, if I could maybe just mention, is one of the things that government should be and is looking at is masks for everyone. Which I think is a good move, and is the smart move forward. One of, you know, for me, we should be reopening the economy with risk mitigation strategies. You know, hand wash, sanitizer at shops, all these types of things. Mm-hmm. But another one of those risk mitigation strategies is definitely masks.
Okay. All right, because that has also changed over the last few days. We started off saying, well, that they don't make a difference unless you are infected. They're not going to keep stuff out from the outside.
So Anthony Fauci, who obviously is the expert in America, who's been sort of Trump's lead guy on this, sort of came out yesterday and admitted that they'd been against masks, not really because masks don't work, but because they didn't want to cause a run on masks when they don't have enough for healthcare workers.
Right.
And I would agree with that. I don't think the public should be wearing N95s. In fact, if I see you wearing an N95, I might physically assault you, because the only thing that will stop me from getting severe coronavirus is one of those masks, because I'm going to have to be up close and personal with people who have what we call a lot of viral shed. Mm-hmm. And I'll need the N95. You don't. Same applies to surgical masks.
What's the N95? Is that one that covers your whole kind of mouth, nose, and it
causes a seal. You're meant to actually have a seal. You're meant to be able to kind of blow into it and nothing kind of happens. And when you suck, you would suck the mask in, not air from the sides.
Right.
So it causes a full seal around your face. But there's evidence showing that just material masks, using sort of T-shirt material, for example, has some effect, not the same as a mask, but up to 70 or 80% as effective.
So all these these people in the suburbs who are terrified that their neighbors are going to pass it on by walking past their house or walking the dog or going to the shops, you should just take your Hermes scarf and just tie it really tightly around your little mouthy wouthy, and then you'll be okay.
If you cut the inner lining of your Louis Vuitton bag, it
drives
out,
me mad.
Then you can
cut the inside of your stupid handbag or your expensive jumper that you bought in Savile Row and use that. Fuck. All right, guys, this IMF thing. Yeah, though, I didn't let Canton talk about this. What do you want to say?
Let me just come back to the IMF thing, and of course, as usual, I have a somewhat contrarian view in terms of how these things are likely to play out. I don't think that we're likely candidates for the IMF in the short term, because the only point at which we're likely to need to actually go to the IMF is at the point at which we need to go into debt rescue. In other words, if we're not able to actually pay the interest on our debt. I don't think that we're anywhere near at being at that point yet. So if let's factor in, we had the downgrade last week from Moody's coming immediately on the heels of the lockdown. We were expecting the downgrade. Mm-hmm. Now, to a large extent, the downgrade is already priced into the market. Mm-hmm. And we've seen the immediate impact in terms of the downgrade was the decline in the rand.
Yeah.
And the decline of the rand, let's be very clear, was also exacerbated by our decline in interest rates that took place. I think it was the week before.
Yeah.
But now we need to take this this view that, in as much as you have the ratings agencies, so and Moody's was the last one that had actually had us down at investment grade. But remember that what the rating agencies do is ultimately an opinion. And it's a very influential opinion. Let's be very clear about that. But consider right now that in the US, which ultimately is the benchmark for where money usually flows to when everything hits the fan, interest rates in the US right now are practically zero. Mm-hmm. Means is right now, places like South Africa, on the assumption that even with our reduced interest rates, that we are continuing to make interest payments on our bonds, that still makes us one of the few places in the world where there's actually an opportunity for investment. Mm-hmm. So, you know, given that that it's already priced into the market to some extent, I think that we're not going to be going to the IMF with a begging bowl until we hit that critical mass where we're just not being able to produce enough to make those basic debt payments.
But Gunther, nobody wants to buy South African government bonds, right?
Gunther, are you still there? He seems to have frozen. Go ahead, Jonathan. You want to say something?
I mean, I probably don't know as much about the IMF as Canton, but I am incredibly concerned about the world economy. I think America is going to trigger potentially another Great Depression. It looks like unemployment there will be greater than it was during the Great Depression. I think there's a graph that hasn't been produced yet. Which is, we know, we all have seen the graph with the rising corona deaths over time. We have not seen economic deaths versus time. And there's a point at which the economic deaths versus time, things like suicide, do people forget that people jumped out of their office buildings when the Great Depression happened?
Well, they did it. There were suicides during the Lehman Brothers crash not so long ago.
Yeah, so we have very short memories, and I am incredibly worried about the economic collapse that's potentially happening. And while I hear all the points about the IMF, if America's economy fails, which it may, that's not a forever. Obviously, it will recover, but if it fails badly enough to put America into something similar and akin to the Great Depression, the rest of the world is going to be in a far worse position, and South Africa is really not well geared to deal with that.
Valdemar, what do you think the political cost is going to be for this virus pandemic outbreak thing having been managed well or badly by this government of ours?
Gareth, if only we had data that show that South African voters punish government for for managing things badly and reward them for doing things right, then I could answer your question. I think that what worries me more about the politics of this is that the consolidation of state power, in my view, is always bad. And I'm not a libertarian who thinks the state has no role to play. But I'm worried, as Jonathan is, about the rights and powers that government retains for itself after this is over.
Yeah.
You know, we're more than a year away from a local government election. The opposition typically performs better in a local government election than the governing party does, especially the DA, because they tend to get out the vote. The focus is not on opposition politics in these times.
No.
Government's role actually matters in these next few months, and it will be scrutinized. The fact that Mkhize is striking even very critical people like us and Jonathan as doing a half decent job, even though we distrust him, given his views on NHI, will help government, I think, to pass off their treatment of this as better than the mean globally. And I don't think they've been doing too badly when you compare them to how late some of the countries took the measures which are regarded as sensible. So there's nothing to be ashamed in our government's treatment of the coronavirus crisis at the moment. But this remains a state apparatus which is deeply corrupt, which is mostly ineffectual. And we cannot rationally expect this government to sustain a high level of performance on COVID-19, given their track record. These are still the same people.
Yeah. I just want to go back because, Canthan, we lost your connection there for a second. Waldemar, in response to your question on the IMF and South Africa still having interest rates which might attract investments, Waldemar said, but we still don't have investors buying South African government bonds thanks to the downgrade.
Yeah. Actually, that's not true, because we actually had our first bond issuance just shortly after the downgrade, and it was fully subscribed.
Hmm.
Look at the yields, Canthan.
Yeah, no, the yields don't, you see, Waldemar, the basic point that I'm trying to make is the question of whether people are going to continue buying our bonds. And the answer to that is yes.
Yes, okay, but it's also making it much more expensive for us to go and borrow. We will have a debt.
No, absolutely, but that's a different story. That's a different story altogether. Because, our debt to GDP ratio is absolutely massive right now, but it's not yet at the point where it's overtaken it. So yeah, you're absolutely right. It's a lot more expensive now, but at the same time, consider that even though we've dropped our interest rates, we're still getting our bonds subscribed based on the fact that the US is sitting exactly where they are right now with 0% interest rates. So it's one of the few places in the world. I mean, right now, if you have to make a decision in terms of that, you are still likely to get some type of ROI. If you consider that the S&P 500 is down, I forget what the figure was. It recovered slightly, but effectively it's tanked. We're talking at the lowest levels they've been for the longest time. And right now, if South African bonds is one of the few places where you can get positive yields, and where the statements that are coming out from our finance minister are relatively solid. And I think that Mboweni has been fairly consistent in terms of, talking the talk, certainly in terms of fiscal discipline and that type of stuff. We're not yet at IMF level.
Yeah, I just to wrap this up, because we've got a lot of, first of all, anyone who listens to this podcast gets answers to what's going on from a healthcare point of view. You get answers to what's going on in terms of the economy locally and the world economy. And we also get answers for irritating neighbors who are trying to impose bullshit laws on you. So far, that's not a bad strike rate, 3 out of 3. Are there other things that are going on that we're not paying attention to because this pandemic has got everybody so focused? Are there things happening? I mean, Ace Magashule is being incredibly quiet through all of this, probably because he has nothing to add. in terms of value. But are there other things that we need to pay attention to? What's going on in China?
Well, Gareth, the latest intelligence report handed to the White House apparently last night suggests that the U.S. now believes that China is vastly undercounting both its deaths and its caseload of coronavirus. Some reporter went to document the thousands of urns in Hubei province, where Wuhan is, of people who've been cremated, presumably after succumbing to COVID. So China is not trusted, of course, for some of their data, and it seems now that that they might be misleading the world about their caseload, and that's deeply concerning. And the other thing that's happening in China that we should watch is that our government still believes that China is the best example to follow, and China is a totalitarian state, absolutely no human rights, where if you rat on your neighbor, you get credits from the Communist Party for being a good citizen.
Yeah, and let's just remember that is something that if you have any idea of individual sovereignty and what the value of that might be, and that could be all you have in the future world economy. It could be all that you have.
I just want to talk about, I'm not sure what's happening in the South African context. I'm sure our government continues to steal, as they always do. And that I highly doubt that changes because of a lockdown.
Yeah.
But I think the interesting thing over time will be once we're over the coronavirus and governments, the media gets tired of reporting on counters. Then really what's coming next is probably some sort of cold war with China, a technological cold war, perhaps, certainly a manufacturing cold war. I think that's what's interesting. There's still an American election this year. It's going to be interesting whether Trump emerges from this very damaged or perhaps as almost emerging as a wartime, victorious wartime type president.
Well, if you look at the Gallup polls, his approval ratings are higher than they've ever been.
Sure, but it's during crisis, and I think we need to see what happens when the Americans think they're over crisis, and then the attack ads start coming. The Democrats are very much trying to use this as a way to get him out. Others are saying that he did a good job and he did the China ban early. I think it's too early to tell, but there is a reckoning coming for China. I think a lot of people, individuals worldwide, feel that China holds a lot of responsibility here and ultimately that they must pay.
All right. Anything to add to that, Kenton? Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, well, I think one of the things that we're not paying attention to on the local front, which I think is going to be massive. Right now, you have a number of people around the country who have been asking a very specific question, which is the ANC government has been able to roll out water tankers. They've been able to roll out sanitation. They've been able to provide housing on a massive scale. And why were they actually not doing this in the normal course of running the country? And the short answer to that, the short answer is that they're able to do that in the context of the emergency declarations, because that means that they're able to override the people who actually have the responsibility for doing that stuff, which are the local authorities. And the question is, will the electorate now be prepared to accept the dominion of the local authorities going forward when they've actually had service delivery provided to them on such a massive scale in such a short space of time? I don't think so. So I think that the ramifications of that in terms of how it upsets the political structures in the country are going to be massive. Really, we're only going to see that happening come next year when the municipal elections actually kick in. And I think that we're going to see quite a few surprises around the country at the same time. My couple of cents in terms of what's going on across the globe. Gareth, I shared with you guys a piece that I wrote about the fact that it was Russia primarily who's providing the single source of aid right now to Italy, whereas and the European Union has gone into lockdown. We are in union, I believe, collapse as a direct result of this. And frankly, you know, I never was a fan of the EU's hegemony and certainly good riddance to them.
Do you think it'll happen imminently, or do you think it's going to take some more time?
take some more time, but it's going. Look, the thin edge of the wedge was already there. In terms of the fact that you've had this rise so Brexit was the most visible manifestation. The Serbian president, said, screw the EU. The people who came to help us were Russia and China. And that's where what we're going to be looking to in future. The usual suspects, The Guardian and so forth, tried to raise outrage about the fact that Boris Johnson didn't want to join with the EU to be buying ventilators. And my logic around that, well, actually, Boris can go ahead and buy ventilators directly for the UK because he has to put the UK's interest first. And that's really the way things should be working. Back in the US, Trump cracked down on the auto industry and said, guys, you need to start actually doing stuff. Guess what? Ford opens up an assembly line and is now churning out ventilators.
Because people made fun of that. They said this guy must be a complete retard to be asking the motor manufacturers to be doing this. Turns out they can.
Yes, it does. And Mercedes has been doing the same across in Germany. Because look, they have the assembly lines, and once you're in a position to actually start tooling the components, it then just becomes exactly the same thing that Henry Ford did 100 years ago.
Jonathan, you want to say something?
Sorry, I know we're going to run over time, but on the ventilators thing, it's interesting, the criticism of world leaders. Trump gets Ford to make ventilators, he's a moron, and McLaren in the United Kingdom are making ventilators, and that's great, you know. Just the point on ventilators, which people don't seem to understand. You get very basic ventilators, and they go up to very advanced ventilators. And the kind of lung pathology that you get from COVID, if you need a ventilator, requires you to have a very advanced ventilator. So these ventilators being built by Ford, being built by Dyson in the UK, being built by any of the motor manufacturers, the bottom line is they don't have the software and the processing technology in them to be able to do what we need to do if you are sick enough to require a ventilator. These patients are getting something called ARDS, which if you can imagine the lungs to be a big sponge, and then imagine that sponge gets filled with some concrete. That's what your lung becomes like. And so you need quite advanced ventilation, different modes of ventilation. And these basic ventilators simply can't do that. So I'm not at all interested. I know the media has not, because they don't have an understanding of this, which is fine, but I'm not at all enlightened or hopeful about the fact that random people are building ventilators. It's not helpful, in my opinion, in the least. And I say that as someone who will be looking after patients in critical care units.
All right. Well, gentlemen, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you all very much for adding your value this morning. And there's lots of it in today's Burning Platform. Valdemar, always good to see you. And I hope you're keeping safe and healthy. We'll probably check in with you again during the course of the lockdown, I hope. Canton, look after yourself in that terrible place of Plettenberg Bay where you're under such duress to be there. And Jonathan, thank you so much, very much, for your particularly your medical expertise today, but also the opinions, which you're never in short supply of. So, gents, it's been fun. Thank you very much. It's the Burning Platform. It's brought to you by Nando's every Thursday between 7 and 8 o'clock. And what a bumper edition today. I would suggest that you send this round to people who are talking nonsense. I suggest that you would share this perhaps with those people who in your family and your friends groups are always sending you WhatsApp voice notes from unidentified people telling you secrets that are suddenly not so secret that everyone in your neighborhood has them. And particularly those ones who think that they're the only one who's ever sent it to you. Send them this and they can actually learn something. Thank you so much for joining us. We will see you tomorrow, 6 o'clock, bright and early. CliffCentral.com.